This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is comic, actor, and writer Wanda Sykes. Her Netflix comedy special, Not Normal, is nominated for 2 Emmys. Not normal is the expression she uses to describe the Trump presidency, which she devotes a lot of time to in the special. During the Obama presidency, Sykes became the first African-American woman to perform at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. She came out right after Obama was elected, which was the same time Proposition 8 made gay marriage illegal in California. She's now married. She talks about race and her family in the special.
Race means a lot. It does. I think about it a lot. Just because of the makeup of my family. Look, I'm married to a white French woman, and we have 2 white kids. Yeah. And now white supremacy is on the rise. And I'm living with a house full of white people.
In her special, Sykes also talks about being diagnosed with breast cancer and having a double mastectomy. And now she's going through menopause, dealing with hot flashes, belly fat, and she's afraid she's starting to grow a beard.
But, you know, there's help, you know. There's a solution. Like, a lot of women, they just take the estrogen. Just take the hormone. But, see, I can't take the estrogen. I can't take the hormone because of the type of breast cancer I had. Yeah. But the irony of it all is like when, you know, because I curse and stuff, and when people say to me, hey, Wanda, you know, really, would it kill you to be a little more ladylike? I go, yes. It would.
We'll hear more of Wanda Sykes' comedy later. Sykes has a recurring role on Black-ish, does a lot of voice work for animated films, and has her own production company. Wanda Sykes, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on your Emmy nominations.
Thank you.
You've been a comic during the Clinton administration and his impeachment. You were a comic during 2 terms of America's first African-American president. And now you're a comic during the presidency of Donald Trump, who some people describe as racially divisive and others describe as just plain racist. Is being a comic now different than being a comic during the Clinton years or the Obama years?
Oh, it's totally different. It's much harder, actually. And you would think, oh, boy, there's so much to make fun of. But really, I can't write anything funnier or more ridiculous than what Trump actually says. What he says, it sounds like a joke. So it's basically, you're just repeating what he says. It's just like doing a parody of a parody.
You were booed by an audience in Boston telling jokes.
Oh, thanks, Terry. Yeah, thanks. Jesus.
Telling jokes about Trump.
Oh, congratulations on your Emmys. Oh, hey, remember when you were booed, Wanda?
And you had called him racist, sexist, and homophobic. Were you surprised to get booed? I mean, these are people who are paying money to come hear you. I would imagine most people who come hear you aren't surprised to hear what you think of President Trump.
Well, you know what? That was my fault. That was my fault because it wasn't my show, you know. And when I say fault, I don't mean that I take responsibility for being booed. I take responsibility as being a comic and not reading the room. You know, it's like I'm in Boston and it was a benefit for the Cam Neely Foundation. And, you know, my friend Dennis Leary asked me to do it. And I've performed there before, and it's a great charity, and it's usually a fun night at the Garden. But this was right after the election. So Dennis goes up, and he does some Trump jokes, and people are laughing. And then another comic goes up, and he does a couple jokes, whatever, you know, some Trump stuff, and people are laughing, another white guy. And so then I go up. And I do it, you know, the first joke is, you know, I get some laughs. It was a Trump joke. And then the second joke was the, hey, you know, this isn't the first time we've had a president who's, you know, racist, homophobic, sexist, but this is just the first one that we can confirm. And the crowd just turned then. And it was like, oh, and then I got it. I was like, oh, shoot, that's right. I forgot. I'm a black lesbian female. And they aren't ready for this yet. You know, it's like white guys, sure, go ahead, come on out. You can make fun of it because we see it every night on late night TV. White guys making fun of the president. Okay, yeah, and especially this president, fine. But they weren't ready to see a black woman who's happened to be a lesbian also making fun of the president. And the room, it was 50-50. I mean, like fist fights broke out in the audience.
Are you serious?
I'm serious. It's Boston. Come on. I mean, really, it was nuts. It was nuts. People were doing the how Hitler moved. I heard N words. I heard, you know, then you hear other people, you know, telling them to, you know, shut up and all that. It was crazy.
So what did you do on stage?
I said, I have to try to somehow diffuse this. So I pulled out my cancer card. You know, I was like, hey, we're here for the Cam Neely Foundation.
Is that a cancer foundation? And,
so it's a form of, it's the fight a form of cancer. Yeah. Uh-huh. And I was like, okay, hey, guess what? We're here for a good cause. You know, I had cancer. And then people kind of like settled down. And then I got them back. I did. I got them back. And there was still some rumblings going on in the audience, but I wrapped up my set, and you know, and then as I say thank you and bye, and as I was walking off the stage, my wife was there, and she runs out on the stage and grabs me, and you know, just gives me a big kiss, and so again, half the audience is going nuts. You know, like applauding, and the other half is like, wait a minute, what's going on? What's happening? Why is this white woman kissing her now? What is going on? And my wife, she's, you know, smarter than I am. So as we're leaving, she throws up the peace sign, and me, still bitter, I gave him the finger. And I believe that was on the front page of the Boston on the Globe or something the next morning. It was pretty funny.
Very much
one of
a
my
mixed message.
Moments.
The moral of the story.
And then my wife and I had to talk about it. I was like, wait a minute. I thought we were both doing the finger. She's like, no, baby, I was doing the peace sign. Love, peace. I was like, oh. Mm. I was like, nah, I was feeling the finger. I couldn't get that index up one. Couldn't get that index finger up.
Oh, that's really funny. Is life for you personally different under President Trump than it was under President Obama?
Yes, absolutely. I have to. You have to think about things now. You know, when you even like something simple as going into a restaurant. You know, you go in and you see it's kind of crowded. And you try to get yourself, okay, you want a table. I have to read the host. I have to read the hostess to see how this is going to go down. Like, oh boy, if this person is, you know, a Trump person, we might as well just go to another restaurant.
Are you concerned because you're black, because you're a lesbian, because you're a famous comic? Like,
you can check all those boxes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So on the scale of annoyed to afraid, where are you now?
Wow. Okay. I'm more on the end of annoyed, because I don't live in fear. It's just like you said, it's just another annoyance. It's just, you know, something that you just got to deal with, like, oh god, really this again? So I'm like 10 on the, you know, annoyance level.
And annoyance in part because you feel like you have to read people more carefully than you did before because it's such a divisive time,
right? And what's so funny, people who are not Trump supporters, especially white people, I can feel like they want you to know that where they stand, which is hilarious because it's like they're being racially profiled now, you know. So I know like white people are quick to tell me, oh, that Trump, huh? Oh God, what a piece of work. And I'm like, we weren't even talking about politics. I just met you. You know, it's just so funny. Where they just feel like, okay, let me just get this out right away.
So I want to play something from an earlier special. This is from a 2009 comedy special on HBO. that was called I'ma Be Me. And this is something you recorded about how you felt after Obama was elected.
First black president. I'm so happy because now I can relax a little bit. You know, I can loosen up. Don't have to be so black all the time. Don't have to be so dignified, you know, because we did it. Black folks, we always got to be dignified. Yeah, because we know if we we just set everybody else back a couple of years, right? Well, we should have killed Flavor Flav like 10 years ago. He has been holding us back. But we did it. Now I can relax a little bit. I can dance on camera. I couldn't dance on camera before. When I was growing up, my mother, she wouldn't even let us dance in the car. You know, we sitting in the car, good song come on the radio, my mother's like, she would stop the car. Do you want to dance or do you want to ride? Because you ain't dancing in my car. White people are looking at you. I'm like, huh? White people are looking at you. I'm like, oh, damn. She was right.
That's Wanda Sykes from her 2009 special. Did your mother tell you that white people are looking at you, so you got to be dignified?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, my parents, I don't know, another black person my age who didn't hear that. Yeah.
How different is it to be on stage when your job is truth-telling and everybody is looking at you? And comics aren't famous for being dignified, per se. They're famous for being, like, comic truth-tellers, sometimes harsh comic truth-tellers. So it's, like, kind of the opposite in a way. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. You know, maybe that's why I love doing stand-up. Maybe that's it. Maybe that's where I feel I can be free. But then again, there is my mom's voice in the back of my head when I'm on stage, and I know there's a line. I do think about that.
So you were the first African-American woman to host the White House Correspondents' Dinner, which used to have a comic until
right?
a couple
yeah.
of years ago. And you were the first comic to be there at the White House Correspondents' Dinner during the first year of the first African-American president. And in one of your comedy specials, you talk about an hour before you went on stage to perform with President Obama and Michelle Obama in the audience. Your publicist or manager came to you with a note saying, please do not use the F word or the N word during your talk. Who did the note come from? The White House?
That's a good question. I don't know if it came from the White House or if it came from the correspondence.
Oh, kind of. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it came from the correspondence. I'm pretty sure the White House would know better.
So did you have to change your?
Come on, Terry. Absolutely not. I mean, I had no intentions on going in that room and using the F word, and absolutely not the N word. Come on, that's nonsense.
So you actually got some grief for that dinner because you were making jokes about Rush Limbaugh, who was at the time one of the most famous ultra-conservative media personalities. And he had said he wanted Obama to fail. And you said that's like saying he wants America to fail, and you hope Rush Limbaugh's kidneys fail. So what was your response to that? What kind of response did you get?
I'm ahead of my time, really. I mean, I called it all. I called it. No regrets. No regrets. Now, was it very Christian thing of me to wish the man's kidneys fail? No. But it was just a funny joke. But that's how I felt about the whole thing, where he was hoping America fails just because there was a black president.
So there is no longer a comic performing at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, because a couple of years ago when Michelle Wolf was the comic and she made a joke about Sarah Sanders and about how Sarah Sanders burns lies and used them for eye makeup to create her smoky mm-hmm. eyes, they decided this is just like too much. Comics have gone too far. We're ending the whole thing of having a comic. We're going to have a historian instead. What was your reaction to that?
It was just ridiculous. It's a funny joke, and it is based on, like you said, in truth. Sarah Sanders Huckabee, she gets up there and she lied every single day to the American public. She lied, and their reaction to this, to say no more comics, I'm like, well, thank you. Now, you know, you're doing us a favor. Because really accepting that job and doing, you know, and going into that room as a comic, it's like hosting the Oscars, but without all the glam and the red carpet and the nice swag bag and all that stuff. You know, we're doing God's work.
So I want to play another clip, and this is from your 2009 HBO special, I'ma Be Me, which sounds kind of funny coming from my mouth, doesn't it?
But you nailed it.
Oh,
I'm
thank
telling you.
You.
I was very impressed. I was like, oh, go ahead, Terry. She nailed that. I'ma Be Me.
So this is a clip about how it's getting harder to be black and a lesbian. And this is from 2009.
It's harder. It's harder being gay than it is being black. It is. Because there's some things that I had... There's some things that I had to do as gay that I didn't have to do as black. I didn't have to come out black. I didn't have to sit my parents down and tell them about my blackness. I didn't have to sit them down. Mom, Dad, I gotta tell y'all something. I hope you still love me. I'm just gonna say it. Mom, Dad, I'm black. What? What did she just say? Oh, Lord Jesus, she didn't say black, Lord. Did she say black? Mom, I'm black. Oh, Lord, Lord Jesus, that's black. But black Jesus. Give her cancer, Lord. Give her cancer. Anything but black, Lord.
That's hilarious. How did you think about that? I mean, how did you come up with that?
I guess it was the realization I had to have this conversation with my parents about being a lesbian. And I was like, wow, this is kind of ridiculous, and it was very difficult. And you know, this is after now we have Barack Obama as president, and I thought about it that I had more rights as African American than I did as being a gay American. Because that night when he won, it was bittersweet. You know, I was so super excited and happy and proud of our country and in the direction we were going. And I'm living in California, so in the same time, Prop 8 passed. So
and Prop 8 says that the only marriage the state would recognize is a marriage between a man and a woman.
Exactly. So then that passed, and it's like, okay, so we move forward, but then they take away my rights to be married. So, yeah, it felt like, wow, now I can't believe now it's actually harder to be gay than to be African American. And that joke was, you know, in for that time, especially now that we do have marriage equality. But there's still a lot of things that we need protection from, you know, like jobs and housing. So it is still, you know, a fight out there. But I don't know. Like right now, no, I don't think it is harder today.
You actually came out during an anti-Prop 8 rally, right? Mm-hmm. It came out publicly.
Right.
How did you choose that as the opportunity to do it?
Well, I didn't even know that I was going to do it. It wasn't planned at all. I was in Vegas performing at, I think, Planet Hollywood, and I had a show that night. And there was the National Day of Protest. And the LGBT Center in Vegas, they were holding a rally. So it's like, hey, let's go. Let's go out and support and protest. So I get there, and it's a large crowd. And the head of the center, she's speaking. And she said, you know, we have someone out here who's an ally, and she's a strong voice for the community, and I'm just going to put her on the spot and see if she will come up and say a few words. Now, I'm looking around in the audience thinking, is Drew Barrymore here, or is Pink here? What's going on? You know, I'm looking around for the ally, and then she said, Wanda Sykes. I'm like, oh, no, I'm part of the family. I'm not the ally. Okay, so I go up, and it just happened. And I made the speech. And then when we started the march, my friends were there, and they were like, you know, you just came out. I was like, huh? And they were like, yeah. I was like, oh, I guess I did. You know, my wife was there, and we went on with the march. And then when I got home back to the hotel room, I'm looking at CNN, and now I'm on the crawl. And I was like, oh, boy. Okay. I guess I did.
What did you say that was the official coming out?
I said, I'm proud to be Black, a woman, and gay.
So once the crawl hit CNN, what happened next in your life?
A lot of text messages. My publicist called and said congratulations, and she was proud of me, and she said that was the perfect way to do it. What else? Yeah, a lot of very supportive phone calls, and it took my parents a while to jump on board.
Did they found out, or did you already tell them?
No, I had already had the conversation with them. Mm-hmm. But I remember my mother specifically asking me not to do that, not to be public while she was, still alive.
Well, how do you handle that? Because your life is yours, and there's a fight to be fought, and you wanted to be part of it, but I'm sure you also wanted to respect your mother. So what do you honor? Do you honor, like, the LGBTQ movement? Do you honor your own sexuality? Do you honor your wife? Or do you suppress all that for a while your mother's still alive, and honor your mother?
It was hard. And, deep down, I look at it as I am honoring my mother, because I'm a product of my parents. And my parents instilled these values and this strength in me. And so for me to deny who I am and to be silent, then I think that would be dishonoring them, because that's not the person that they, made me to be. So I had that conversation with them from that angle. And eventually they got it. And now, we are so close, and everything is great. They're amazing grandparents. I think now their concern is more for my safety than anything else.
I'm really glad to hear that things are good between you.
Thank you.
Do you think your mother was more surprised than she might have been because you, in the 90s, you were married to a man for several years?
I think so. Yeah, I can see how that could be misleading. the old bait and switch. I can see that.
did religion figure into her response when she didn't want you to come out publicly, and when she was really upset that you were gay.
Religion is, it's you know, grounded in everything that they do. So, absolutely, yeah.
Did you go to church a lot when you were young?
Yes, yes. When I was young, you know, teenage years, there was a one point when we had just moved, and I found a church before they did, and so I was, you know, so I got them to go back to church, and I still go to church, not that often, but there's a church that I love in Los Angeles, and so when I'm, you know, when I'm in LA, and I try to make it there. You know, I read the Bible and more so spiritual writings and stuff like that. So yeah, I lead with love. Doesn't mean I'm gonna vote for Marianne Williamson, but she makes some great points. She makes some great points. Although she did say she was gonna write a check, so I don't know. That check sound pretty good. The reparations check. I don't know.
So your wife is French. She's white. Mm-hmm. You have two children who are white, mm-hmm. and you joke mm-hmm. about how you're living in a house with white people and you're a minority in your own home. So that's very funny. But I'm sure there's some truth to that, too. Is it unusual for you to be in your own home and be, like, the racial minority in your own family?
It is. It is. It feels weird when I think about it. But now, when it's just the four of us, then, you know, if I don't think I think of it then, but it's like when her family is there, or we have a bunch of friends over. I do kind of look around and I go, man, there's a lot of white people in my house right now. Wow. And it's not like I don't like it or it makes me uncomfortable. It's just I noticed it, and it's like, wow, okay. And sometimes I'll call a friend like, hey, man, what you doing? You want to come over? And he goes, what, you got too many white people in your house? I'm like, yeah.
Had you considered motherhood when you were in a heterosexual marriage? And when you imagined the possibility of motherhood, if you imagined it, did you imagine it differently in a straight marriage than you did when you were in, as you are now, in a lesbian marriage? Because now you're the mother of two children.
Before, I didn't want kids. I had no vision of having kids at all. I remember when I was little, I said I pictured myself with kids, but there was never a man around. It was, I don't know if maybe he died in my mind or something. I don't know, but I did see myself with kids, but there was never a dad around. That was when I was little. Now, then when I was older, I was like, oh, God, no kids. I don't want kids. And when I met my wife, that was her thing. Look, I'm right up front. I want kids. And I was like, well, can you give me like 6 months to think about it? And let's just continue dating and then we'll see. And if I know it's not for me, then we'll just call this quits and you go on and find somebody who wants to have kids. So she agreed. But after that 6 months, even before then, I quickly was like, why wouldn't you want kids? Why wouldn't you want to start a family with this person? And the best decision I've ever made.
What do you love about being a mother?
I guess it takes you out of yourself. Just to be able to just love something so much and just want to be there and take care of them and not worry about yourself. It's just good to know that I have that capability. it's like, oh, I can do this. Oh, I thought I was so self-absorbed, but this is, wow, look at me parenting and being caring about something else, you know, other than myself. Yeah, it's just beautiful. I'm just learning a lot about myself. So I guess that is kind of like about me again. Damn it! I thought I had this.
So your wife gave birth to twins, and you joke in your latest comedy special about how people are always asking you, because your two children are white, how come you didn't choose an African-American donor so that the children would be biracial and would reflect both of you instead of the donor being white. So you joke about that in the special, but you must have had pretty serious conversations about that.
We didn't have that many conversations about it. I was good with it. I was like, look, you're doing all the heavy lifting. You're getting the shots. You're going through the process. You're going to carry them. You're delivering them. Of course you want the kids to look like you. Why not? You earned it. Go for it. And also I was like, why do the kids need to look biracial to mirror us? Like I said, we're two women. We can't make a baby. So their skin color to me wasn't like, you know, something that I needed to feel like they're my kids. That, you know, they are my kids, and they identify us as the French mom and the English mom.
Were you surprised you had twins?
No, we put two back. We put two eggs back. And
thinking maybe one of them wouldn't take.
Right. And she wanted to put three back. And I was like, look, I'm going to tell you right now, if all three take, we leaving one at the hospital. That's the deal. So she said, and also the doctor advised not to put three back. So we just did two.
Right. Okay. So something else that you joke about in your comedy special is having a double mastectomy. And not the most hilarious subject, but, you know, you get some good material out of it nevertheless. But the irony is that you found out about the cancer when you were getting breast reduction surgery. So what's the connection?
Do you mean, like, why did I
have breast reduction? How do they discover it during breast reduction?
Through the pathology, the pathology of the tissue that they removed from the breast reduction.
Oh, so they found
Yeah, they found cancerous tissue in the, right.
So they just routinely do a pathology when they do the breast reduction?
Right.
And what they found was ductal carcinoma in situ, which is sometimes referred to as stage zero breast cancer. And I don't think it's typical to have a double mastectomy after that, but you decided you really wanted to do it. If you don't mind, can you tell us how you thought that through?
Well, here's the thing. It wasn't like they found a lump and was able to, isolate it and remove it. This was after, like I said, after a reduction. So they couldn't really identify where it came from.
Oh,
you know,
I
they
understand.
Could just say, oh, it was the right one. And also I have a incredibly strong history of cancer on my mom's side. You know, we've lost, I mean, I've lost, aunts and to breast cancer, ovarian cancer. My uncles, all the boys on her side, they've had prostate cancer. I mean, there's something, and I just was not taking any chances because they wanted to put me on tamoxifen, I believe it's called, and I would have to like just stay on that, and what I understand it like talk about mood swings, so that's not good for being a stand up comic to be on stage and all of a sudden you have a breakdown, menopause is doing that enough for me right now, but I was like I don't want to just be on some drug, and still having to get checked over and over again. To me, it's like just waiting for the shoe to drop. So I wanted to do the most And I just had, you know, we just had kids. The kids were, you know, maybe two. So I was like, look, I just want to get this taken care of. And my doctors, they also advised the same thing. They was like, this would be the best option as far as not having to, you know, worry about it as much. Mm-hmm. I mean, I still have to go get checked. But, yeah, and it was tough, but I feel great, and I got some perky boobs. Got some perky boobs out of it.
You probably had to decide, what size do I want?
Yeah, you know, I started to go small, and I said, you know what, screw you, cancer. I'm going to go even bigger than when I started.
So let's talk about how you became a comic. You started working at the National Security Agency. I think you had like top security clearance, and you were working as a procurement agent. Do I have that right?
Yes, top security clearance, and I was a contracting specialist or procurement officer. Yeah.
So what does that mean?
I bought stuff, basically. Anything from, you know, I guess surveillance equipment or something to office furniture, whatever, you know, I service the agency. So whatever someone needed, they would, you know, send in, you know, purchase order, or if it was detailed, I would get drawings or, you know, blueprints and would go out and price it and deal with the contractors to, you know, to do the job or build whatever piece of this equipment is that, you know, that was required.
What was the security clearance process like for you? I'm thinking a lot of comics, when they were young, would not have wanted to put themselves through that and probably would not have gotten a security clearance.
Well, I mean, I come from a military family. My dad, you know, he's a retired colonel in the Army.
He worked for the NSA too, didn't he?
Well, he more of the Pentagon. My dad was at Pentagon.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, I was never a bad kid. So, I had a clear path. It wasn't a problem getting a clearance. The only thing I smoked weed in college, you know, and I was just honest about it. And he was like, all right, don't do that again. I'm like, all right, cool. And that was pretty much it.
So how did you think of going into comedy and leaving your job at the NSA? I mean, they're very different professions, needless to say.
Yeah. I always loved comedy. We watched a lot of comedy at home growing up. You know, we had all those great variety shows. And, you know, Moms Mabley was, you know, still is like my hero. Remember seeing her on like the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, and so comedy was always in the background, and I just got bored at work, and I looked around and I was like, this cannot be my life for the next 20 plus years. I need to be doing something else. And there was the radio station, local radio station. It was a Coors Light was sponsoring a talent show, and comedy was a category. And it just hit me like, you know what? I should write some jokes. Never been to a comedy club. Didn't know any professional comedians. And I mean, I knew some preachers. We had a lot of preachers in our family. You know, they're performers. So I said, okay, I'm just going to write some jokes. And I did. And I auditioned, and they put me on the show, and it all started from there. I fell in love with it.
So the first time you were in a comedy club performing, what was your material like?
Oh, God. It was basically doing an impression of what a stand-up comic does. You know, like, it was just generic jokes. I think I did a joke about the auto shade. Remember those big sunglass cardboard things?
Oh, yeah, that you put on the windshield.
You put in your window.
Yeah.
Yeah, you put in your windshield. I was reading it, and it had instructions on the side of it. And I'm like, who really needs instructions for this? Because, you know, it says to make sure you remove it before starting your car. And I'm like, who needs that? Who's driving around 95 with the, you know, big sunglasses in the window?
Because it covered the whole windshield, like you wouldn't be able to see anything.
Yeah.
Okay. So some of your material now is is really very personal, and some of the things that like women are reluctant to talk about, you talk about on stage. For example, going through menopause, having a belly in part because you're going through menopause. You've even named your belly Esther Roll after the actress. How did you decide to do that?
I don't know. It was like when it popped up, I was like, "Oh my God, look at this fat roll I have right here. Where'd that come from?" And I don't. Then I just started I just gave it a voice one day. I think I was ordering food, and I was like, "You know, I should get a salad." And then I just looked at my gut, and it was like, "I want some French fries." And I was like, "Okay, all right, you're right." And I would have conversations with my gut, and my friends would crack up. I think the first time I did it, I was with my friend Kim Whitley, and she just died laughing. She's another comedian. She died laughing, and I think Esther wanted French fries, and I said, Esther, they don't have fries. They don't fries on the menu. And Kim was like, "Yes, that's fries." I said, "Shh, shh." I said, "Esther can't read. She's dumb. She can't read." And Kim just started laughing. And she's like, "I heard that." So and then it just became a thing. And she's like, "You have to do that on stage." She's like, "Girl, you have to. Esther, people would love Esther. You have to." And so I put us out there, and everybody loves her.
Well, Wanda Sykes, thank you so much for talking with us. It's really been great. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Terry. Thank you.
Wanda Sykes' Netflix comedy special is called Not Normal. It's nominated for 2 Emmys, Outstanding Variety Special and Outstanding Writing for a Variety Special. If you'd like to catch up on Fresh Air interviews you missed, like our interviews with New Yorker staff writer Jane Mayer about her investigation into the sexual misconduct allegations against Al Franken, or with mystery writer Laura Lippman, or with Washington Post tech columnist Jeffrey Fowler about how your phone and smart speaker are spying on you, check out our podcast. You'll find lots of Fresh Air interviews. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Mooj Zadie, Thea Chaloner, Seth Kelly, and Joel Wolfram. I'm Terry Gross.